The stories of anger and its deadly effects are easy to find. I was looking online yesterday at a couple of things. The Waco Newsbeat reported last month there was a man who was dragged to his death behind a pickup truck. And every time I hear that, I think what a horrible, horrible thing that is. The man who is charged with his murder is his brother. The two others, men who are also under investigation in the death are another set of brothers. And apparently the story is there was a night of the Hill County Sheriff reported there was too much drinking, too much anger, and it ended in the death of a man at the hands of his brother and two of his friends. What a horrible story to read about. The Washington Post also reported a case last year, I think it was the fall of last year, where a murder was linked to a case of road rage over the installation of all things in a residential area of a speed bump. And the man who helped get the speed bump placed was murdered because people dislike having the slow going through the neighborhood. What a terrible story, again, of someone's anger leading to a death. Today I'd like to continue the series I've been doing on the Ten Commandments. I thought we would talk about the commandment that deals with murder and with the underlying issue of dealing with our emotions, particularly dealing with the emotion of anger. Let's first read the command. I have it on here. I'm going to just use the arrow keys, so I'm going to have to get this a little closer to me. It's in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. I have it on the screen. It's one of the shorter ones. Don't even have to turn. In the King James Version, it says, "Thou shalt not kill." Now, that's the King James translation. There are many other translations that have a different word there, and I'll get to those in just a second. By the way, I don't know if you heard about the Sabbath school teacher who was talking about the Ten Commandments, and she was telling her students all about how they needed to honor their father and mother, and it was important for them to do that. And then she said, "Well, are there any commandments that tell us how to deal with our brothers and sisters?" And without missing a beat, one girl said, "Yes, don't kill." that one does have something to do with it. Anyway, most modern translations have murder. "You shall not murder." The New King James says, "You shall not murder." The New American Standard, NIV, Amplified, there are lots of different New American Standard Version, New Revised, Today's English, World English Bible, lots of the Young's Literal, lots of different translations have the word murder instead of kill. "You shall not murder." And as I say, most modern translations will have that, and if you look it up, they will say that that's a better translation of the word. To translate it as murder. Why is that? Why is it that translations are now saying that it's probably better to translate this word as murder? Well, let me show you the word itself. This is from the online Thayer's Greek Lexicon and Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew Lexicon. Notice that the Hebrew word rotsak, I believe is how it's pronounced. It does include murder. But realize it's not the only translation of that word. It's not the only way that word is used. As you look at the list of meanings up here, it can mean something that is a premeditated event, something that you have a quarrel with someone, you have anger towards someone, you have this bitterness or this rage, and you think about how you're going to get even with them, and you plan it out, and you execute your plan. That's a premeditation, obviously. It could also involve a death that is accidental, though. That same Hebrew word is used of deaths that are accidental. We'll talk about number 35 in a little bit. Number 35 has to do with the cities of refuge. And it is this same Hebrew word, rotsak, that is translated as death or killing when it is an accidental killing. It is not a premeditated event. I picked up this rock. I threw it. I didn't know there was anybody nearby. Happens to have rolled down the hill, hit somebody, and killed them. Or flown over the hill and killed someone. It was an accident. I had no idea the person was even there. It was not a premeditation. It was not, in that sense, a murder. It was an accidental death. Now, in the Old Testament, there was a means for you to deal with that. You could flee to one of the cities of refuge. But it's that same word. So whether it means to murder or to kill accidentally, that Hebrew word is the same. So why is it the modern translations use the word murder? The fact that this same word can be translated as kill has even led to some people posting ridiculous articles on the internet claiming that God commits murder, that any time he's killed anybody he's allowed people to be killed or said this, go wipe out Amalek, well, there's God breaking his commandments. So you can't trust God. Ridiculous argument. Why is that a ridiculous argument? First of all, anybody read any of those? Oh, weird guys who goes out and read stuff on the internet. Why would we say, well, that's not a valid argument. What do you mean God's guilty of a murder and therefore you can't trust him? And how would you combat that type of an article? What would you say about an article? Or how would you talk to someone about that? None of you read that kind of stuff. You don't think about that. Well, let me just give you a couple of thoughts. Got a thought? Okay, go ahead. Share with me.
God created life.
Sure. God created life. Therefore, it's his to give or take. God also has the power to give life again. He's the one that has that. Let's see, I think that's Deuteronomy 23. Where he says that I'm the one. There's no one like me. I'm the only one. I create life. I give life. I take life. Where is that? Now my eye doesn't fall on it. But he does make that statement that he is the one who created life. He gives life. I take life. My eye doesn't fall on it. But he's got that ability because he's the creator. It all belongs to him. So whether he gives or takes life, he's also the one that has the ability to give life back to individuals. He alone has the ability to give them a resurrection at the right time of life, or the right time in his plan. So again, why is it that people would say this is murder? Why is it that God is concerned about murder? Well, obviously he's concerned about human life. Human life is precious to him. In fact, if we go back to the time of the flood, right at the end of the flood, remember the statement that God said that any human life that is taken, there is a penalty for that life being taken. Let's go back to have this one written down, Genesis chapter 9. Let's go back to Genesis 9 and look at the statement there. Right after the flood, God points out that human life is precious in his eyes. Yes, he created it. And so therefore he has the right to end it when he chooses. But that's the point. He reserves that right to himself. In verse 5, he says, "Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning." Now this is God who has the right to demand, who has the right to choose, who has the right to decide who lives and who doesn't. "For your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed." For, now sometimes we ask the why. Why does God do this? Why does God do that? Why does God say this thing with the other thing? Why are things the way they are? Because, here God's giving us a little bit of insight into his thinking, because in the image of God, he made man. "I made man in my own image," God is saying, "and therefore I consider human beings, man, woman, children, I consider them all human beings, I consider them precious. Their life is precious. So if somebody kills one of my creation, one of those made in my image, I'm going to demand an accounting for that. There has to be, somebody has to pay for that precious life that has been taken. Think of it just like we would. We would think of our daughter or our son. We would think of their lives as very precious. We would be extremely distraught if somebody took the life of one of our children. God feels the same way about human beings in general. Now, in Numbers 35, go back to Numbers 35, and of course, here's another reason that we say, well, it's not wrong of God. God even established a means whereby He said, you, as a nation, I've given you that authority as a civil entity in Numbers 35 to deal with instances of the death of a human being. He established an elaborate system of six cities of refuge, three on one side of the river, three on the other, and told ancient Israel, you need to distinguish between an accidental death and something that is premeditated, something that involves emotion, something that involves anger, where individuals are angry with one another. So Numbers chapter 35, this whole chapter, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit when we come back to this, but you'll notice, read just a verse or two of this. In verse 11, he says, you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. So God set a distinction between an accidental death. The Hebrew word ratsach is a general term that means death of another human being, whether it is murder intentional or whether it's an unintentional murder. So God is saying, I want to draw the distinction here now so that you understand accidental is different than an intentional thing. Now, we certainly know that this was in existence prior to Mount Sinai. Sometimes as we've gone through the commandments, we've talked about that, pre-Sinai occurrences. What instances do you think of where it's clear from the wording of the text prior to ancient Israel getting to Mount Sinai and God codifying the commandments there? What instances do we think of where it's very clear that God does not want human beings going around just killing each other indiscriminately? What instances of murder we have? Cain and Abel, sure. One of probably the most famous. Cain and Abel, right at the very beginning, isn't it? May as well go there. Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4 is where the story of Cain and Abel comes up. Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, talks about Cain and Abel being born. Abel brought a gift. Cain brought a gift as well. God respected Abel's offering, but he did not respect Cain's. Verse 5 of Genesis 4 tells us this. And it says, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So here we have the emotion of anger. Cain was angry. He was angry because he was not accepted. His sacrifice was not accepted like his brother's was accepted. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door. Sin lies at the door. You're on the verge, you're at the point of doing something rash here, Cain. Realize you're standing on dangerous ground right now. Sin is right there at the door. Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. You need to be able to conquer that urge. And Cain talked with his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Here's this same concept of God saying the blood of a human being cries out for some kind of justice. Your brother's blood, Cain, is crying out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you'll be on the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment's greater than I can bear. I can't handle this. Surely you've driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I'll be hidden from your face. I'll be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. It'll happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. Now, it's rather interesting to think about Cain complaining about his punishment when he didn't die. God didn't say, okay, you killed your brother, I'm going to take your life, blood for blood. Cain just said, you know, this is too much for me. I can't bear it. I can't handle this, God. You're too severe in your punishments. And he argued that anyone who found him would commit the same act that he had committed against his brother. Kind of interesting to think about some observations of Cain. He had uncontrolled emotions, denied his responsibility of caring for his brother. He certainly believed his punishment was unfair, and he believed that everyone else had similar values as him. Everyone's like me. They'll get angry, they'll kill me. They'll see me, they'll kill me. Because they're mad at me killing my brother. Kind of a sad perspective that Cain had. Well, let's address a little bit more why murder is used by most modern translations and looking at God's instructions to the nation of Israel. Let's go ahead and turn to Numbers 35. Murder is not tolerated from God. Numbers 35, first of all, we can look at verses 30 to 34, because this chapter goes into a fair amount of detail about distinguishing what is murder in God's eyes and what would be an action that would lead to the death penalty, corporal punishment for someone who had committed murder, that they would in turn have their life taken. That would be the death penalty for them. Genesis chapter 35, verses 30 to 34. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses, but one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. There are other instances where God said, don't establish something just on the mouth of one witness. You need to have corroborating evidence for serious situations. Two or three witnesses are required before you can take action on this particular event. Moreover, he says, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. Don't let anybody buy their way out of a death penalty. If they truly have committed murder in ancient Israel, God said, I want you to make sure you carry that sentence out. You shall take no ransom for him, verse 32, who has fled to the city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. You shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Now again, he's talking about murder from the perspective of individuals who have committed murder, who had this in their heart. Don't take a bribe, don't let somebody buy their way out of it. Shedding of blood, of human blood, defiles the land, and it has to be made right. Now, the death penalty is given for other things as well, but here specifically for kidnapping and other issues, but here specifically he's talking about murder. Now, notice God made a distinction based on an intent. If we go back a couple of verses, yes, I did put this in here, verses 14 to 15. You'll appoint three cities on this side of the Jordan, three cities shall you appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. These six cities are for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger or for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there. The emphasis here is on it's an accident. It was not premeditated. It was not something that was intentional or willful. This was an accidental death. Serious, yes. Serious. So serious that God said, you can't stay at home any longer. You've got to flee to this city. I think what that did to the family and to someone's family who's involved in this, they had to flee to a city and live in a city somewhere. They couldn't travel at will. They had to stay in that city until the death of the high priest. Normally, the nearest of kin would automatically be appointed by God as the avenger for murder, but if it was an accidental death, if the person could get to the city of refuge, then he could live. He wasn't put to death. He had to remain there till the death of the high priest. Verse 25, I think, is the one that says that. Yes, he shall remain in the city, remain there until the death of the high priest, who was anointed with the holy oil. And then after the death of the high priest, he could go back safely to his own house and his own property. But look how carefully God explained the need to look at intent. Look at verse 16. In verse 16 he says, "But if he strikes him with an iron implement that so that he dies," this is after he talks about an accidental killing, "but if he strikes him with an iron implement so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death." In other words, the very fact that you have something that is made of iron in your hand and you hit somebody with that iron implement, God says that's enough to show the intent in your heart was to not just have a squabble with this person. Your intent was to kill him. You wanted to end this squabble forever. You keep reading in this in verse 17, "If he strikes him with a stone in the hand by which one could die and he dies, he's a murderer. And the murderer shall surely be put to death." Okay, now it's not iron, now it's a stone, but it's a stone that could kill somebody. He's not talking about a little piece of pea gravel. I hit him with pea gravel. He's talking about something that you could use as a weapon. Verse 18, "Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon by which one could die and he dies, he's a murderer. And the murderer shall surely be put to death." So even the context here was that other things that could be used may not have been something that you went out to find this person and kill them. But if you get into a squabble with someone and you pick up something that's going to kill them, then he says God considers that murder. Now, let's look a little bit further. What if it's only a hand? Well, even there, God says there is a possibility that it could be ruled a murder. Verse 20, "If he pushes him," let's pick it up there, "if he pushes him out of hatred, or while lying in wait, hurls something at him so that he dies, or in enmity," what's enmity? Well, enmity is anger. It's the emotion, the fighting with somebody in an ongoing feud. It has the kind of a connotation of that, this enmity between you and someone else. "In enmity, he strikes him with his hand so that he dies. The one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him." So even the hand that kills when lying in wait, or out of a cause in a situation where God says there is enmity and you strike someone, that's worthy of death because it is considered a murder in God's eyes. And since the word hatred is there, maybe it's a good thing to think about anger, talk about anger. Anger is a general term. Indignation implies deep anger, but indignation is a synonym, but it really sort of implies, in some senses, justified, indignant and dignified, or indignation over something. Rage is vehement anger. It's anger that's amplified. And if anger is nurtured, it turns into that. It turns into rage or fury. It turns into hatred, which is intense or extreme aversion or hostility, ill will toward someone. So where does anger begin then? Where does murder begin, actually? God distinguishes the difference between an accidental death and murder. Where does it start? Well, Jesus Christ, I think, is a good source for us to go to recognize where murder begins. And God, through Jesus Christ, tells us in Matthew 15 that it comes from the heart. That's where it begins. God has distinguished the difference between accidental death and murder for ancient Israel. Murder involved intent. It murdered often involved anger or long-term hatred. Jesus Christ in Matthew 15, I'll turn and read that. Matthew 15, beginning in verse 15. Peter asked for an explanation of the parable, and Jesus said, "Well, don't you understand it? Things that go in the mouth are not really what defiles a person." Verse 18, "But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornication, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things that defile a man, not eating with unwashed hands." So Jesus says murder is something that starts in the heart, starts in the mind. It starts with our human emotions. That it begins there. It's the beginning point of it. He called Satan a murderer from the beginning. John 8:44. I won't turn and read that one. I think we're familiar with that one where he says Satan was a murderer. He was a murderer from the beginning, from the very, very start. I would like to turn to Ephesians chapter 2. Let's look at Ephesians 2 and notice what Paul was inspired to write. It said, "You he has made alive, who are dead in trespasses and sins." It certainly applies to all of us all year long, but as we come to the Passover season, we're reminded of that. We're given life because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. "He's made you alive, you who are dead in your sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom we also once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others." Satan's spirit works in the world. It moves individuals. It moves with emotion. And certainly results in the Galatians 5, works of the flesh, 19 through 21. They include hatred. They include contentions. They include outbursts of wrath. They include murders. Reminds me of those synonyms of rage, fury, anger that's nurtured into hatred. And we see a lot of that in our world today. In fact, we see a lot of that that goes on from generation to generation even, don't we? There's this inbred, almost sustained hatred of another group. We see a lot of that going on in our world today, ethnic groups or religions or tribes of people, long-term hatreds that go on and on and on. And of course, we go to Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, another passage that we're probably very familiar with, where Jesus talked about murder. And he says in verse 21, "You have heard it was said of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause will be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, will be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, you moros, you person totally, you're not even worthy to be called a person, you have absolutely no value, no worth whatsoever, shall be in danger of Gehenna fire." And if you let your emotions take you to that level, he says, you're in danger of Gehenna. You're in danger of the hellfire. We've said that murder is an issue that starts in the heart. It starts in the mind. Christ's words here indicate that. That's where it starts. So we have to fight against that spirit of the world that capitalizes on hatred and the misuse of emotions. We need to change that habit. We need to come out of the world and not be like the rest of the world around us. We need to control our emotions. We can personally not express the hatred. We can refrain from the bodily attacking of others or using words that emotionally injure others. But this is why we've often said that anger is the spirit of murder. It's the beginning of murder. It's where murder starts. It's hatred. The spirit of murder is there when we nurture hatred. So this is a good reason why many modern translations use that word murder. You shall not murder. Because when we tie it together with what Jesus Christ says in terms of the emotion, what starts in the heart, that's where it comes from. You tie those together and it's very clear that it's not just the killing per se, but it's the emotion that is involved in it that becomes murder. That's the prohibition. God himself, in some places in the Old Testament, gave commands for his nation to take care of people. The avenger of blood was to kill someone who had committed murder. God established that as a law within ancient Israel. So murder is why the modern translations translate that commandment as "don't commit murder." Let's think about this now. How does this apply to us? Well, obviously it applies to us from the emotional perspective, that we don't harbor hatred toward one another, that we shouldn't harbor hatred toward anybody. But as we come toward the time of Passover, it got me to thinking about how do we think about the opposite of murder? What is the opposite of murder? What's the opposite of the spirit of murder? Love, yeah. If you think about that, the opposite of murder is not just refraining from murder, but it's love. The opposite of stealing, we were told, if you go through that passage in Ephesians, is not only do you stop stealing, but you start working with your own hands. There's a positive side of it. You don't just act like a thief between jobs and refrain from stealing, but still want to steal constantly. You turn and do something totally different. You work productively with your own hands to produce something. That's the opposite of it. What's the opposite of murder? Well, the opposite of murder is to love one another. Think about what God said. Let's look at some admonition for us as Christians, particularly in this Passover season. Remember Matthew 5? We're right here in the Sermon on the Mount. The next verse says, verse 23, "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you," you know that there's some argument going on that you've left unsettled, "leave your gift before the altar. Go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift." Be reconciled. Be at peace with your brother before you bring your gift to God. That's kind of a high responsibility, isn't it? How do we reconcile with everyone? Well, Jesus Christ says when we come before Him, and when we come before Him as at the Passover, we are bringing the best, the highest, the most expensive gift we can bring, aren't we? We're bringing our life. Because Passover is a sign of recommitting our life, giving our life to God, that we've given that life, we're recommitting that life to Him. It's the greatest gift, it's the most expensive gift we can bring. So before we bring that gift, I think there's an application in this to Passover. We need to make sure we're at peace with our brothers and sisters. Remember what Jesus said would be the sign that we would belong to Him? Talked about this about 4 or 5 months ago. It's in John, isn't it? That sign. Let's go back to John 13. As Jesus Christ came to that last evening of His life as a human being, as God in the flesh, He had a lot of instruction to give the disciples. And in verse 34 He says, this is John 13:34, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are My disciples, if you have love for one another." Loving one another, being at peace with one another, being in a peaceful state with our brothers and sisters is commanded by Jesus Christ. It's not just a suggestion. As I said a few months ago, it's doctrine. It is teaching of God. It is teaching of Jesus Christ. God doesn't want the spirit of murder dwelling among His family members. Now, Paul wrote about this in several places. Romans 5, he talked about peace, that we have peace with God because we're justified by the blood of Jesus Christ, that His blood takes care of the shedding of our blood. That's what brings us into a peaceful relationship with God. And of course, we should be at peace with our brothers as well. 1 Corinthians 12, he wrote about the church. It's like a body. It's got all these different parts. And those parts are to coexist peacefully. You don't just start cutting off body parts indiscriminately. That's not showing love to the body. It's not being at peace. And he talked about those parts needing to work together peacefully. 1 Thessalonians 5, I do want to turn to this one and read this one. In 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul also wrote to the church at Thessalonica, and I guess we'd have to start back at verse 12 because the sentence starts there. It says, "And we urge you, brethren," 1 Thessalonians 5:12, "we urge you, brethren, to reconcile those who labor among you," I'm sorry, "recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves." Be at peace among yourselves. That means we've got to be peaceful toward one another. We've got to have that frame of mind, that perspective, not picking on one another. I don't mean to jest. We do that sometimes in fun. But I'm talking about the real intent of the heart. Not harboring hatred for one another. Now, somebody recently asked me, well, how do I reconcile with someone who refuses? Well, what if someone won't reconcile with me? Makes it a little more difficult, doesn't it? Makes it a lot more difficult when someone won't reconcile. When you've tried and they won't reconcile. What advice would you give someone who asks that? Can you force somebody to reconcile with you? No. Do we have any scripture that would indicate God understands that? Got a hand in back?
There's a scripture that says, as much as life is in you, live peacefully with all men.
Romans 12. Yep. Years ago, I remember having a situation where I tried and tried and tried to reconcile with someone, never could seem to accomplish it. And this passage was pointed out to me. I've remembered it ever since. Because I thought, I've done everything I can do. I don't know what else I can do to reconcile with this person. I have tried everything I can think of. Paul does say in Romans 12, let's read verse 17 and 18. He says, verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Now that means that somebody is treating me wrong. I don't have the right to treat them that way. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. As much as depends on you. You do your part. We come down to that again, don't we? It's always, we're responsible for our part. We do what we can. We can't force anybody to do something they don't want to do. We do our part, though. And that's what God expects of us. He expects me to do my part. As much as it depends on me, live peaceably with all men. As much as depends on me, keep my mind clean of hatred. Control my emotions. Control the way I think about other people. Don't let yourself start dwelling in that realm where you begin to talk yourself into why this person's such a horrible person and they deserve your anger and they deserve your disdain and they deserve... Don't go there. Don't go there. We're told to be at peace with one another. Now, we keep this verse in mind. You can't throw this verse out. That you cannot do it with someone who will not reconcile. But it comes back to us and our mind and our approach. 1 John chapter 4, this is one we probably, many of you probably thought of as well, is an important passage for us to think about when we come to this topic in terms of how we view other people. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7 says, Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. He repeats that a little bit later, down in verse 20. Let's read verses 20 and 21. He says, If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. God's words through John, you cannot hate your brother and love God. You don't really have the love of God if you're hating your brother. He's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he's not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. It's a command from God. Again, it's doctrine, it's teaching. Teaching from God to us. We cannot hate our brother and love God. So, can you reconcile with everyone? You can try. You can do your part. I think God expects us to do our part. We read that in Matthew 5. Before you take your gift to the altar, see if there's a way to reconcile. Now, if your brother refuses, certainly what God says in Romans 12, he understands. It's what's our part, though. You do what you can do. You reconcile with those you can reconcile with. And those that you can't actually reconcile with, how do you handle that? Well, you get your mind, you get your attitude clear. Don't hate them. Don't harbor that hatred. If you do, you're harboring the spirit of murder. Is there anyone you're harboring hatred for? If so, you need to get rid of it. Reconcile if possible. I understand you can't with everyone. So those you can't, make sure you do your part. To me, it's what God expects of us, that we do that before we go before God's presence, and certainly before we go there for the Passover. So the sixth commandment is a constant reminder that humans don't inherently know how to handle our emotions. Sometimes we let them get out of control. We emotions are good. God made them. They're good. They have value. They can make life exciting. There are a lot of positive emotions, and there are some negative emotions that in their place sometimes can have a part in our life also. God does say, be angry and don't sin. There is such a thing as righteous indignation. But we humans always want to push the envelope of what's good, don't we? And we tend to carry on too long with it. We let the sun go down on our wrath and harbor hatred. So we don't want to do that. We want to use emotions positively the way that God wants them to. The sixth commandment, I think, is a good reminder. Let's keep the sixth commandment. I've kept this kind of short today, but let's approach the sixth commandment from the perspective of I'm going to keep it not just in the letter, I'm going to keep it in the spirit. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to look into myself, I'm going to examine my mind, I'm going to look at my attitude toward other people. If I'm harboring hatred, I need to get rid of it. And I need to do that before I come before God on the night of Passover.